The following podcast is a production of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
All right. The Supreme Court of the Nomination will have to order. The Honorable Chief Justice Herb Yazzie presiding. Chief Justice is accompanied by Justice Lorraine Ferguson and the Honorable Leroy Bologna. The matter before the court, docket number SCCB 6206, Helen Joe, individually and as mother and as the guardian of Mario Nelson Jr., as surviving on the heir at law of Mario Nelson Sr., deceased, Helen versus Roy Black, et al., at the lead.
We have a hearing on an appeal scheduled for today. The counsel for the parties has received notice that they have 20 minutes, and if the appellant wishes, they can reserve up to 5 minutes of time for rebuttal. We have that understanding. And the court in Remanis case was very interested in the application of traditional concepts of nullier and how that would be applied in a situation that we have where there are concepts of sovereign immunity and also comparative negligence involved in this case. And on this appeal, after the remand, we still have those questions. And so we realize that the procedure and the legal mechanisms used to operate a comparative negligence concept in the Navajo has not been developed, at least in the civil procedures that we have. So we will be interested in your suggestion on how that should be applied and used in the Navajo system. So with that, is the appellant prepared?
Yes.
Appley?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Mr. Rosenfeld.
Good afternoon. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. The district court ruled that Navajo customary law and statutory law does not allow Roy and Christine Black to be held accountable for their contribution to the death of Mario Nelson Sr. That result is wrong, and it requires reversal. With respect to the doctrine of nullier, the case of Jolene Nez versus Peabody Western Coal stated that nullier is a flexible concept. And this case, the facts of this case, we submit, requires the court to adapt the nullier principle to the multi-jurisdiction situation where there are multiple tortfeasors where not all of them can be brought before the court. It seems, at least from what I've read, my understanding is that nullier is about restoring relationships, and there's no essential element that it be done all at the same time with everybody involved. We understand that is the tradition, but given the modern reality of state boundaries, sovereignties, or for that matter, just insolvent parties, in order to carry out the purpose of the custom, it will need to be done in some instances where, say, the state of Utah cannot be brought in. And the district court said, no, it's all or nothing. We disagree. We also believe that the doctrines of comparative negligence and Nalia are compatible. And this court's order of remand sort of said it very well. Under comparative negligence, the court or the fact finder allocates fault among the respective individuals at fault. And then Nalia governs the type and amount of damages. And I remember vividly the language from Benally versus Big A Oil Company, where this court said, in some instances, Nalia could be just symbolic. It did not equal an adequate award of money damages under Anglo-American personal injury law. By the same token, I would think there might be other cases where the amount of Nalia would be greater than the amount awarded under Anglo-American concepts of personal injury. I believe that the fear that the court indicated of overcompensation is a false one. Nobody is going to pay more than their fair share as they see it. And that is a self-correcting mechanism, so that you can have a system, we submit, in which there may be absent parties, and what needs to be done in those circumstances is what the other jurisdictions have done. They use the concept of a non-party at fault. For example, in this case, if Roy and Christine Black believe that the state of Utah was significantly at fault, they can name the state of Utah not as a party but as a non-party and say that fence wasn't maintained properly and it's Utah's fault, and that gets submitted to the jury or the judge. That's how they do it in other states, and we are suggesting that that practice needs to be adopted so that cases like this one can be adjudicated. The reason that cases need to be adjudicated is because otherwise there's no remedy. And Navajo, at its core, Navajo customary law talks about making restitution, getting relations right, bringing back harmony. And if you leave someone out of the picture, which is what the district court would do, that doesn't happen.
Mr. Rosenfeld, I have a question for you.
Sure.
In the allocation of responsibility or liability for damages, and you try to make it work with the concept of sovereign immunity, is it your position that the Navajo Nation in this case can be brought back in at least on the question of the allocation of liability? Immunity, yeah, would prevent the government from paying for their share of the liability, but shouldn't, in the allocation process, they at least be brought back to answer what their position is as to their portion of the liability if they were to pay?
Okay, I have 3 points to make to that. First, I don't think the Navajo Nation can be brought back in as a party because they are immune from suit. Secondly, if the law or the basis that the Navajo Nation is not liable is that they had no duty to enforce the grazing regulations, then it would not be proper to consider the Navajo Nation as a non-party at fault. But if, in fact, they did have the duty to enforce their grazing regulations or their livestock regulations, then not as a party but as a non-party, the failures of the Navajo Nation could be considered. But again, that consideration would just go to the allocation of fault, not to the award of money. It would reduce the amount of damages that Roy and Christine Black would need to pay. I did want to talk about the default judgment.
Okay. Yes. One question that I had too
Who is responsible for naming persons or entities to sue?
Would
it be you or the other party?
Well, it's always the plaintiff's. It's desirable for a plaintiff to sue anybody at fault who is solvent and findable. I don't know that that's a responsibility. That's just sort of what plaintiffs will do. And this is an atypical case because plaintiffs were not aware of these people. Then I would think once sued, the defendant looks around to see who else might be at fault, or indeed whether somebody is entirely at fault. And that is the defendant's responsibility, and that is what this court said in the Totticini case. They said if the defendant is going to try to blame somebody else, they should bring them in. And then, of course, the court has that power, too. I wanted to mention sort of a practical way of dealing with the situation that came up in this case. If you go to federal court, in order to file a lawsuit, there's a civil cover sheet, which was adopted by administrative rule of the court. And you need to list connected cases, the subject matter, and a lot of statistical information just to get past the clerk and file your case. The problem that arose here of the court not knowing or not being informed would have been caught through that mechanism, and that's one way to do it. Another way is I know that the Navajo Rules Committee is working on revisions of the rules, and it could include in those rule revisions, as some jurisdictions have, disclosure requirements.
I have a question for you. I couldn't discern from the record, but was there any actual discussion at the trial court when the nation made a motion to have the matter transferred to Wondurunk? Was there any discussion at that point as to the need to also bring the other defendant into Wondurunk? Could that case have that case against that defendant remain in Kayenta instead of being both transferred?
There's nothing in the record, and I was not counsel at that time, so I'm not aware of it. The district court, I think, got very concerned about the default judgment, and I want to talk about that, especially in light of your recent decision in the Bradley versus Lake Powell. A default judgment is a judgment until it's set aside. It's a valid judgment, we know. But it seems to me the big issue is whether the default judgment was an adjudication on the merits or not. And in the Lake Powell case, where Bradley initiated his claim and then didn't show up at a hearing, and then the evidence was presented and the commission made findings on the law and facts, that was an adjudication on the merits, as you said. This case was just a simple default. Edward Black didn't answer the complaint, didn't show up, so we followed the rule, got a default. The plaintiff came in, testified as to her damages. The judgment is issued. That is not an adjudication on the merits, and that is what the authorities say.
Did the plaintiff in this case at the Wondurunk District Court level ask that they have a hearing on the merits?
I'm sorry?
Did the Wondurunk, when this case was before the Wondurunk District Court, did the plaintiff ask that the case be heard on the merits to get at a default judgment?
The record indicates there was no such discussion. The transcript is attached in the record, and she simply came up and testified as to her damages.
Should the counsel have insisted that there be a hearing on the merits?
No, the rules don't require it, and this was just the formality to get a default judgment. No, I don't think there's any reason to have it. And in fact, when you have a default, you're pretty well assured that you're not going to collect. And you're just going through the motions to at least get that defendant disposed of. I guess I'm down to 5 minutes, so I think I better stop.
You still have 5 minutes, and you also have 5 minutes reserved.
Oh, I'll do that.
I don't want to lose my 5 minutes. The other thing I do want to say is, in our view, and I don't know if it's part of this case or it should be separately done through the Rules Committee, it seems to me that there needs to be disclosure rules in civil litigation in the Navajo courts. The federal rules have it, the state rules have it, and what happens in Navajo court is the parties don't know very much and are not given very much information prior to trial, and a lot of information is not known by the court and by the parties. Then they show up at a trial, and either there's an ambush or by one side or the other. It shouldn't be that way. The Navajo rules do have discovery procedures, but they don't have disclosure procedures.
And I have a question for you. What do you know about the relationship, if any, between Edward Black and the couple, Christine Black and Roy Black?
Well, I don't know of my own knowledge anything. I don't know from the record anything. I do know from talking to my law partner something, but I don't think it would be proper to, unless you want me to tell you what I understand.
At least, are they in the same family?
They are in the same family, but they were not living together in the same camp. As I understand it, and they were not both taking care of the horses.
Thank you. Proceed.
Chief Justice Yazzie, Justice Ferguson, Justice Bodoni, thank you for the opportunity to speak, and in the Navajo Nation, it's still morning, so good morning. Let me express my appreciation to the American University Washington College of Law for their hospitality, as well as to Dean Grossman, Professor Rosser, Michael Smith, and Benjanita Bates for their efforts to coordinate and make this possible. My name is Justin Vaughn. I am not Diné. I am Belagana. I have not had the opportunity of a grandmother to teach me the way, but I have had some opportunity to read what this court has written with regard to Navajo custom and tradition, and I will do my best to address some of those issues today. I represent Roy and Christine Black. Chief Justice, to answer your question, Roy Black is a brother of Edward Black. One of the things that I found when I was admitted to practice on the Navajo Nation many years ago, when my first hearing was set in Shiprock, I, living in Cottonwood in the Verde Valley, realized that to go from the southwestern corner of the Navajo Nation to the northeastern corner of the Navajo Nation where Shiprock is can take approximately 5 hours. My first lesson with regard to the Navajo Nation is it is large. I also learned that there are many routes that one can take. There are a choice of roads that can lead you from one part of the Navajo Nation to the other. And I found that in the trip to Shiprock, I could take Interstate 40, where it travels from Flagstaff to Gallup, and either turn north from Gallup, or I could go through Window Rock, the capital of the Navajo Nation. I found that I could travel north initially to Kayenta, travel through the majestic Monument Valley up to the Four Corners and over to Shiprock. I found that I could travel through Chinle and see Canyon de Chelly, and go over the switchbacks over the mountain where it is filled with flowers and trees, and it is beautiful. It is stunning in just a wondrous way that I've never experienced anywhere else, and still travel to Shiprock. And Your Honors, what I've learned in this case is that there may be many roads, there may be many ways that we can compare and contrast different theories, but whichever road we take, we end up with one destination, the destination being the dismissal of this litigation against Roy and Christine Black. And the roads are somewhat similar to what I've just described. There is the Anglo-American path that may take you one direction but result in that destination. There is a majestic path.
Let me ask you a question.
Certainly.
Since we now know that Edward Black is the brother to, who is it? Roy Black. And nullier, the concept of nullier or comparative negligence might pit a brother against another brother. Would peacemaking be appropriate here?
Peacemaking most certainly would be appropriate, Your Honor. But the peacemaking process would require that the parties be brought together. The process that has been pursued here is to keep the parties apart, to keep them in separate proceedings, and in fact there's been no request for peacemaking in this case. But the notion of peacemaking, the fundamental essence of Nullier, would be best served by bringing the parties together, and that's what was reflected in the decision.
I'm talking about
issued out of
the future, resolving the problem in the future. Would that be appropriate?
With regard to resolving the problem in terms of a proceeding to accomplish that, yes. But that is not what has been pursued. In terms of the basis for the appeal that's been presented in terms of the effort to pursue Roy and Christine Black in district court, peacemaking has not been pursued, has not been requested. And it really comes down to two issues with regard to this appeal. First is that this court should not allow causes of actions against different individuals arising out of one accident to be in separate courts with the plaintiff's knowledge. And the reason is that Nullier, as set up on the Navajo Nation, the peacemaker proceeding, is not served when people are divided. It is served when people are brought together. And the second issue is that an individual plaintiff cannot elect one remedy and seek the benefits of that remedy, in this case, a judgment out of the Window Rock Court, and then pursue another remedy. And the reason is because one is to live by their words. And those concepts apply both in Navajo custom and tradition, as well as if we look at comparative fault, as was in this case. As this court is aware, this matter involves an accident that occurred on June 10th of 2002 on U.S. Highway 163 when Mr. Nelson was driving at 1:30 in the morning and his vehicle struck a horse. Miss Joe has then brought various causes of actions, and Roy and Christine Black deny that they are responsible or at fault at all and have maintained that. What happened was Miss Joe, who was a passenger in Mr. Nelson's vehicle, first brought a claim against Mr. Nelson, and you have seen in the record that she recovered with regard to her claim against Mr. Nelson. She also brought a claim against the state of Utah, claiming that the state of Utah was responsible for the horse being on the highway. And you have learned from the record that she settled with the state of Utah. Ms. Joe then sued the Navajo Nation and Mr. Edward Black in a proceeding in Kayenta, which was removed to Window Rock, claiming that the Navajo Nation and Mr. Edward Black were responsible for the horse being on the highway. And that is WRCV 105603. You've received portions of those in the record. The suit was then filed against the Blacks on June 10th of 2004 against Roy and Christine Black in a separate cause of action without efforts to consolidate, without efforts to join Roy and Christine Black with Edward Black On June 10th of 2004, a separate cause of action was filed. Then on July 26th of 2004, in what is perhaps the most significant event in the analysis, Ms. Joe appeared in the Window Rock District Court asking for a default judgment against Edward Black. And, Your Honors, I respectfully disagree that it was not a decision on the merits. Her counsel's statements, and that transcript is attached as Exhibit L to our Statement of Facts, which is Index Listing 65. And that transcript confirms the representation to the Window Rock District Court, if I recall correctly, Judge Sloan, and the representation was made that liability was not an issue. The statement was made at that point, after all of these other claims had been asserted, the statement was made to the Window Rock District Court that liability was not an issue. The judge accepted that at face value as the representation of the attorney, took testimony from Ms. Joe as to the amount of damages, and rendered a judgment reflecting liability, and full damages against Edward Black. There has never been any dispute from appellant that in fact the judgment is a reflection of full liability and full damages. While they claim there's an issue as to collection, there has never been any dispute as to their representations resulting in a judgment of full liability and full damages against Edward Black.
Mr. Vaughn, let me ask you another question.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you agree with the Kayenta court that the party's absence preclude the court from applying nullier or comparative negligence?
As applied in this case, absolutely. And this court has instructed that it is the district court in remand of this case, as well as the Benelli Mobile Oil decision and the Singer versus Nez decision, that it is the district court responsibility to determine the application of nullier. I believe she did so with regard to this case. And the reason why that's an important distinction is that there was no determination or effort to bring the parties together. The principle of nullier, as set forth in Allstate versus Black Goat, is both a process and a result. It is not simply an amount of money to be awarded. It is a mode of payment, and as this court set forth in Navajo Nation versus Crockett, nullier is focused upon talking things out with respect and honesty. And so Judge Geraldine Benally, the Honorable Geraldine Benally, looked at this case and determined that this was not an effort to talk things out with respect and honesty, and this was not a case in which the process was being served because it was being divided out. Based upon that, and reflecting upon Chief Justice Yazzie's question, despite sovereign immunity, it would be, I think, of assistance for this court to indicate that although the Navajo Nation has sovereign immunity, the Navajo Nation as an entity can nonetheless be invited to participate for purposes of nullier, for purposes of peacemaking, and can be a part of that discussion. The state of Utah could have been invited to be a part of that discussion.
I have a question for you.
Certainly.
Shouldn't it be the responsibility of the defendant, if the particular defendant holds the position, I'm not totally responsible for the damages, but other people may be, isn't that the responsibility of that person to attempt to bring those people into that action?
It is not when there is a separate action that Roy and Christine Black did not even know existed. The action had been brought against them, and they became aware of the separate judgment after the fact. That judgment is a final decision. So when you have a situation where appellant knew that these other actions were going on and yet did not bring everybody together, and yet Roy and Christine Black did not know and learned after the fact that all of these events had occurred, and again, a Window Rock District Court was told that there was no liability issue and that it rested with Edward Black a month and a half after Roy and Christine Black were sued. And Roy and Christine Black were not aware of that until after the fact. There is no opportunity. The appellant had the opportunity to bring everybody together and chose their option. And having chose their option under the cases such as Benally versus Begay Well and Benally versus Broken Hill, this court is instructed that it's unfair to choose a remedy, receive the benefits of that remedy, namely a default judgment, and then seek another remedy. And Roy and Christine Black have maintained throughout that they are not at fault in this circumstance.
I have difficulty in analyzing this case for under the concepts of comparative negligence and nullier without the trial court having ever determined who owns or is responsible for that horse. And I'm gathering from your position that you deny, your clients deny ownership of the horse. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. That's absolutely correct. The issue of comparative fault under an Anglo-American system and its comparison to nullier is also an interesting issue. And what we see in Judge Benally's decision is application to this case, where she says comparative fault cannot be used because other parties are not present at appellant's choice. Nullier cannot be applied because other parties have not been included under appellant's choice. But the issue of application in this case is quite significant. Comparative fault, when the judge looked at this case, it was clear comparative fault is not being used to try to restore harmony, to try to accomplish the goal of nullier. What is suggested instead by appellant is that comparative fault means separate cases can be filed against each individual defendant arising out of a single accident, and that a non-party at fault designation can be performed by each of those defendants. And appellant has said in prior briefing and has not disputed in current briefing that it is acceptable for those cases to go to trial to a jury, and it is acceptable for those cases to result in inconsistent results. And I believe Judge Benally's primary concern is reflected in original decisions as well as the decision on remand by this court, was that if that is allowed, it opens the opportunity to and the desire to split up cases, not for purposes of nullier, but for purposes of trying to obtain money and claiming that in each case that non-parties at fault can be designated.
Isn't the purpose of comparative negligence to make a person whole from different people? And isn't the goal of nullier the same thing?
If it is brought in one case and not divided up in the manner that has been done here, then yes. And under the Navajo Nation Code, the enacted statutes of the Navajo Nation, in fact, comparative fault is recognized. In an appropriate case that is brought, the parties are brought together, and comparative fault, if the parties cannot discuss and agree, the matter is presented to a jury.
The nullier is a concept where the tortfeasor has a relationship with the person, the victim. So they ask to be made whole by that person. Comparative negligence, the same kind of concept occurs. You go after people who you think is responsible for your injury.
Absolutely.
At a certain point.
Absolutely, Justice Ferguson, and that's exactly right. And that is done in one cause of action, not by dividing people up. There is not a jurisdiction cited to you by appellant that states that cases can be split into multiple causes of action. And in fact, Judge Benally's prior decisions, both her original decision and her decision in response to the motion to amend, cite the state and federal cases that hold that it is inappropriate to divide those cases into multiple causes of action. Justice Ferguson, you are exactly right. Comparative fault, when all is brought into one case, allows a jury to decide upon who should pay each proportionate share. In this case, we don't have that opportunity for the jury. We would have to if this case were amended.
Let me ask you another question then. I think it's very common to have several tortfeasors, and it would be good to bring them all at one point, but sometimes that's not possible. Are you saying that because it's not possible to bring all parties? In this case, Merlin Joe would lose everything.
And in cases where it is not possible, in fact, the courts have recognized that impossibility, and Rule 19 recognizes that impossibility. But in this case, it was possible. There is a claim of impossibility as to the state of Utah, but that's the only one. The other parties could have been brought together and should have been brought together, but even to this day, there's been no suggestion or there's been no motion to consolidate those cases, no motion to set aside the default judgment, nothing in that regard. And what the jury would be faced with in Kayenta is the fact that there is a judgment for full liability and full damages against one party out of Window Rock. And a jury in Kayenta would be asked to issue a decision of the jury that Window Rock District Court finding was somehow in error, was somehow wrong. And the Kayenta jury cannot reconcile that. And if the Kayenta jury does award some amount of damages against Roy and Christine Black, which we would not anticipate because they were not at fault, but if they were to award some amount of damages, we have two inconsistent judgments. And that's exactly what Nalier is intended to prevent, comparative fault is intended to prevent, and Rule 19 of the Navajo Nation Rules of Civil Procedure is intended to prevent. Under Rule 19A2, it states inconsistent results are grounds for dismissal of the case. A1 states that that splitting a cause of action and not including the parties together is grounds for dismissal of the case. So once again, Your Honors, whichever road we take, whether it's under the principle of Nalier, whether it's under comparative fault, whether it's under Navajo Nation Rule of Civil Procedure 19 and the procedural rules and the statutory code of the Navajo Nation, whichever route we take, dismissal remains appropriate.
One last question. We're still developing our comparative fault statute. At this point, we're seriously looking at developing the procedural aspects of it. Do you have any thoughts as to what comparative thought methodology that we should consider at this point? I know that Arizona has an act that's very comprehensive, and maybe we could use that as a guiding principle for us. Any thoughts on that?
Your Honor, thank you. I think first and foremost, comparative fault should be applied in a way only to the extent it's consistent with Navajo custom and tradition, the overriding principle of Navajo law, and specifically with Nalier. To the extent it is inconsistent, then Nalier would have to prevail over application of comparative fault. And I think Ben versus Burbank gives a good example set by this court of where Navajo principles would take precedence over either a statute or an applicable procedural rule. And I think that's paramount. And a decision of this court that confirms that, I think, sets a good standard. In terms of applying specific principles of comparative fault, again, number one would be that they're consistent with Nalier and not inconsistent. Number two would be that this court determine, as it as recognized by statute and as has been recognized by this court, that principles of comparative fault not inconsistent with Navajo law, this court can turn to other jurisdictions in manners in which it's been applied. In Arizona, it's been applied in such a way as to allow parties to allocate fault under ARS 122506. It's also allowed them to identify non-parties, but it has never allowed a person who is a plaintiff in a case to split up the cause of action into multiple cases. It allows a case with identification of parties and identification of any non-parties, and that's what it provides.
Is it your argument that as long as there's a default judgment that has not been removed or altered, that there can be no peacemaking arrangement made for the blacks, all of the blacks?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why would you make that argument?
Because peacemaking, as was set forth, should involve all the parties talking it out, not the appellant claiming in one proceeding that they are entitled to keep this judgment of full liability and damages against one party, and then going to another proceeding, participating in peacemaking, claiming that that party is entirely at fault and should pay the entirety of damages. That's the problem here, and there has been no request by appellant to set aside that default or consolidate these cases. Appellant wants to keep that default. Whether they pursue collection now or later is their choice, but they want to keep that default judgment. And so clearly that has that is something that, although they want to say to this court it has no significance, it does. But at the same time, they want to pursue Roy and Christine Black, and they have asked in their briefs for this court to instruct the lower court not to tell the jury about other decisions, not to tell the jury about the default judgment, and that's
let me ask you a question on that. How is the amount that was entered in the default judgment relevant to the case against Ray and Christine Black?
Because it was determined by Judge Sloan to be the total damages based on a hearing at which Roy and Christine Black were not present.
Ray and Christine had a duty to, according to the complaint, had a duty to the victim here. How do they get off the hook because of the default judgment?
Well, either one of two things will happen if this matter goes through litigation in Kayenta. Either they're not at fault, or if by some stretch of the imagination, and again I'm not conceding this, but if they were determined to be at fault, then what appellant is suggesting is that a Kayenta court should determine an amount of damages. Now we have two inconsistent judgments. We have a judgment in Window Rock that says that liability rests with Edward Black and a full amount of damages there, at which Roy and Christine Black were not only were they not told, they were not present, they were not represented, they did not have the opportunity to address issues with the court of allocation of fault, nor discuss openly with any other parties as to any allocation of fault, any application of nullier. And so there would necessarily be two inconsistent judgments. And the problem with splitting up causes of action and pursuing one defendant in one case to a final judgment, regardless of whether it's default or not, the problem of doing that and then pursuing another defendant who you could have had at the same time, because you sued the second one before you requested and received your default judgment against the first, the problem with doing that is inconsistent results.
My concern here is normally in a negligence case, you would find negligence. You'd find a duty and you'd find, you know, the elements before you talk about damages. Here we're talking about damages before we even find negligence. and the case was dismissed because of you know, the, under the topic of damages?
Well, it was dismissed because of the separation of parties into separate causes of action. I understand what you're saying, Justice Ferguson, and respectfully, the liability issue and damages issue go hand in hand here, because the default judgment was, as we've confirmed on the record, represented both. It represented a determination of liability based on the representations of appellant that there was no issue as to liability, and therefore a full judgment of liability was issued against Edward Black. A full finding of damages was issued against Edward Black. And so both of those issues were addressed in full by the Window Rock District Court judgment. Appellant doesn't dispute that. They just state that they haven't collected on that judgment. Therefore, they can sue other parties in as many other forums as they wish.
In this particular action, the plaintiff listed an XYZ corporation and an ABC partnership. I believe that was done because it was an acknowledgement that we don't know who all the parties are at the moment, but we will add them as we go along. Are you saying that under the Navajo system of nullier and comparative negligence, that parties shouldn't be able to do that because you got to bring everybody in at the moment you file a lawsuit?
Well, the Navajo rules of civil procedure allow for amendment of a lawsuit, and it is a common practice for appellant's counsel to include those ABC corporations, individual John Does. But when you identify them, you bring them into that cause of action. And that's why those you would also see those in the Window Rock action. That's why Roy and Christine Black could have been conceivably brought in the Window Rock action. Then they would have had notice. They would have had opportunity to appear with regard to any judgment against Edward Black. They would have had opportunity to participate. They were not given the due process opportunities to do so. And so that's what is supposed to occur with regard to the amendment procedures under the Navajo Rules of Civil Procedure.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, very briefly. For purposes of this appeal, Roy and Christine Black are liable. They can't deny liability. The allegations of the complaint are taken as true. So the issue before this court is whether Navajo law, whether this court's going to let these wrongdoers off the hook because of a procedural irregularity, if you will. Now, with regard to the default judgment, it costs money to track down Mr. Black, to find him. He obviously did not want to appear. If the court thinks it's important to consolidate the cases, fine. If the court thinks it's important to join him as a party, fine. He doesn't care. He's made that clear. And what it turns out is that the party who does care is the party with insurance, Roy and Christine. They're the ones who had control of the animals, and they're the ones who are responsible. We didn't know it when we originally filed the suit. We found it out later. But to basically dance around these procedures and to evade the substance is not consistent with Navajo law. There is nothing in the record of the default judgment which suggests it's an adjudication on the merits. And there's nothing in Navajo law which suggests that a tortfeasor should get a NALIA credit because somebody else paid damages. Thank you.
I have a question for you. The statement at the Window Rock District Court by the plaintiff as to the extent, her position as to the extent of liability, is she to be held to that statement?
Yes, Your Honor. Her statement, but her statement, as I recall it, was my damages are $300,000, my son's damages are $300,000 for loss of consortium and $300,000 for loss of support, period. I think that's all she said. And yes, I think since that was sworn testimony, that could be used as to set a cap on the amount of damages that could be recovered. I think that testimony would be admissible.
Thank you. The court wishes to thank the parties for their arguments. We have also read the brief submitted in this case. I'm going to make a question or submit a question to both of you at the moment before I close this hearing. Where did the trial court at Kayentum, upon remand, request further briefing before it made its subsequent decision, or were there oral arguments allowed before the Kayentum court made its decision that's now on appeal?
Your Honor, the answer is that there was quite a bit done. There was a request for all discovery and all documentation to be provided to the court. Mr. Rosenfeld's partner, Mr. Buffington, submitted a stack of documentation that he also copied to me that just about filled a banker's box, Your Honor, and that was provided months. Were allowed for digestion of that. A summary judgment was provided by our office with statement of facts and the documents that are seen attached to Index Listing 65 with those statement of facts. The court did hold oral argument, and after oral argument, after reviewing all of the information, rendered the decision that is pending on appeal before this court today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The court will take this matter under advisement. The court again thanks the parties for their presentations. And for the record, the court also wishes once again to thank the College of Law at American University for their hospitality. And we also thank all of you for attending and listening in on our case this morning. Thank you.
All right. The court is adjourned.